Here we are. We did it. We're back on Rock to Recovery Radio, live here on KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM, human-crafted radio. Also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. If you're having some issues, you got to look them up. They run great programs, mental health, addiction, all sorts of help they're giving people and doing great work. I am your host, Wes Geer, here in the studio. Why am I here? I always like to check in on that. This is, Rock to Recovery Radio. What we like to do is talk to, you know, rock stars, celebs, rad humans, movers and shakers out there that have battled things like addiction or mental health or other challenges like PTSD, TBI, to overcome and not just survive, but thrive and get into what I call the vortex of radness. Because there's some magic in these stories with these people we talk to where things are going so bad, you know. You can't imagine they're ever going to make it out. I was the same way, and many of my guests the same way. And somehow, some way, things start changing by these programs and these actions that we're taught to do. And they take hold. And life transforms, we transform, and the miracles are there. They're evident. We see them all the time. So in doing so and sharing this light and these stories, you know, hopefully for people out there that are maybe struggling or lost and need help or answers, maybe it'll help you feel not so alone. Or for people who are in recovery or working on it in some way or another on their own, maybe this helps keep you connected. You know, because for me, I can't do it alone. I can't recover alone. I can't thrive alone. I need your help. I need your love. I need your guidance, all that stuff. So tonight, I've been super excited about the show. He's like an old friend, yet a new friend. Super neat guy. Full of love and joy and happiness. And man, he has a story. My buddy Eric, he's like, oh man, you got Todd Z on tonight. Wait till you hear his story. I know a little bit of it. And as you guys know, I always do a little bit of research, but then I always like to leave some to discovery so we can explore it together. But tonight I have Todd Z. Is that your favorite moniker?
Todd Z?
Yeah. Do you go Todd Zalkins? Z-Man?
Yeah, man. You keep
What's
it
your
loose.
Favorite one?
God, I don't know. I've been called Z-Man since I was like eight.
Z-Man.
But you call me whatever, man.
Z-Man. We got the Z-Man in here.
Oh, man. Todd, whatever.
I'm
happy with whatever.
Yeah.
I'm just happy to be here.
I'm so happy you're here, bro.
Yeah.
We've got a few episodes of Quality Time lately, and I got such love for you.
Likewise. And I was stoked to have you on recently, and you and I had a good chat. And thank you for having me tonight.
Yeah. I'm stoked to have you here. Thank you for making the journey from the LBC down to the LBC.
No traffic, man. The big pride parade was going on up there. And you know what? It was all good. I got down there about 40 minutes, man. No problem.
Nice.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm already getting hot talking to you, so I'm going to get a little, you know, take off some clothes.
You know, you can turn this thing into Chippendales. Do what you do. It's your show. You know what I mean? You do what you do. I'm comfortable.
Scary thought. So, dude, let's get right to it. Like, you know, you have such an incredible story. There's so much we could talk about. You know, usually in our story, when I interview guests, we talk about, you know, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. But you also, grew up with the Sublime Crew. That's a big part of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Long Beach, and we grew up together. You know, from grade school on, and backyard parties, and watch those guys turn into amazing musicians and maniacs, and we all were crazy together.
So where does your story start for you? Because you're a sober dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. How long you got?
I a little over 11 years. My sobriety date is February 17th of 2007, and just like you said, brother, I have not done it alone, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, had a lot of help.
So we never blame... You know, we try not to blame, like, how things went on other people. You know, some people have worse lives and they're fine, and other people have traumatic lives, and, you know, so who knows? But for you, where does the story start? How was your childhood, you know, growing up?
Well, I grew up in Long Beach, and you know, I'm the product of a pretty gnarly 6'4" alcoholic dad who was in the Marine Corps and was he boxed in the Corps, and had this real loving, beautiful 5'4" beach blonde mom who was not an alcoholic, and in fact, I've never seen her drunk. And you know, I think I just grew up watching Dad drink, and you know, that's took my first pulls of beer from Dad and Big Schlitz Tall Boys in his car, and he left my mom and my brother when I was about 7 years old. Mm. So our home life was a little fractured early on, and so. Yeah, you know, I never knew what I was going to get with that man when I would see him. You know, that Jekyll and Hyde thing, man. It was either a lot of love or a lot of just gnarly behavior. Sometimes a left hook, sometimes just some terrible behavior, yeah.
And, you know, I have this, like, little thing I say, you're normal. Not you are normal, but that was your normal. You know what I mean?
That's a great way to put it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I became conditioned to experiencing certain things, witnessing certain behaviors, and that was normal to me. You know, my dad always smelled of liquor.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything but, like, cologne for me was, that might have been his cologne, Schlitz and booze and whiskey and whatever the hell he was drinking. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, so do you know, when we're young and that's our normal life, it's almost hard or impossible sometimes to go, hey, this ain't right. So when did you have feelings that, like, this doesn't feel so good?
I don't think never, because I can't honestly even, that's a great question. You know, I was scared a lot as a kid. And so for me, fear was a normal thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so how am I to know what normal is? I mean, I would see friends who had a non-fractured home and I would see a more stable environment. But when I'm used to more chaos and stuff like that, see, that's my norm.
Yeah.
So
I get
how
that.
Am I to say, you know, what's right or what's wrong? All I know is that I had to fend for myself a lot, and I had to witness a lot of scary stuff. And for me, that was normal.
Yeah. And so, and when we're used to the chaos, that feels like home for us.
Big time.
And so when we're around, like, people who are just nice and kind and loving and there's nothing there, it's like, this is weird. I'm not used to this.
Yeah, the Brady Bunch scenarios and the Waltons type stuff, it really tripped me out. You know, silver dollar pancakes on the weekends, perfectly made, and everything is that tripped me out.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable, isn't it?
It made me a little comfortable, but then it was like, yeah, I mean, this looks good and all that, but I don't want to paint it like I didn't have a good childhood, because my mom provided a great deal of love.
Yeah.
A beautiful woman with a wonderful heart. It was just that side, the alcoholism, when you witness it, it taints you and it scars you.
Yeah.
Right?
So how was school going and your relationships, you know, outside of the home? Did it impact that?
Well, yeah. From what I understand, from what everybody's told me and from what my memory serves, is that I was pretty crazy and I'm pretty convinced that I did want everyone to like me, and I was a pretty gregarious kid, and I was outgoing, wanted to be funny, and wanted to entertain you, and I think that there was this insatiable kind of desire for validation outside of the home, because see, at home, I never really knew what was going on, so my peer group, it was very important for me to have that sense of you're okay, that sense of,
you know, top approval.
That approval and that, you know, we love you, man.
Yeah.
And if I didn't get it completely, I would be like, man, how come a few of those dudes or those chicks don't like me? And I'd fixate on that. But when I discovered the drink, it all went away.
Yeah. Now, but you were like a funny guy, right?
I could be very funny. Yeah,
not me. See, I was the same way. I wanted approval, but I would try to be funny, and people just thought I was an annoying, smart, you know what, word. And,
well, I could be that too. You know, I could be funny, and I could be a wise ass. I could be tragic in a lot of ways too, and I could hurt some feelings, unfortunately. And but I was never, I don't think, very malicious intentionally.
Right.
I was a jokester big time. You know, I was running for class president in eighth grade, in middle school, and I was rallying for beer in the fountains and Quaaludes on campus.
In eighth grade?
And I
that
won the election.
Your campaign?
Yeah, and I won the election.
I'm surprised they didn't.
I didn't even make posters.
Oh, my gosh.
I just put the word out. Hey, this is what we're going to have.
Okay, so let's zoom in on this. This is great, but let's zoom in on this. So if you, in eighth grade, want beer in the fountains.
Yeah, what's the problem?
You are already drinking some serious quantities at this time, or what?
Not so much serious quantities. I mean, my friends and I were already indulging in alcohol, and yeah, when we drank, we would get loaded. Yeah. I wasn't a daily drinker then, but the effect that alcohol gave me was something that I appreciated. narcotics hadn't entered the picture yet. Mm. But yeah, man, it was, put it this way, the party was very attractive to me at a young age.
Yeah, do you have that story that many do? I took my first drink and I felt fine, you know, instantly I felt better or felt a part of or whatever.
You know what? I don't know about that. I'm not going to, you know, you hear this, the common theme is, well, it filled this dark hole, this hole in my soul. I can tell you that in my experience, that when I drank alcohol, what it did was it allowed me to, it gave me this camouflage. You know, it was this medicine to allow me to not be so consumed about what everyone was thinking about me. And it certainly made me bolder, more bolder.
Absolutely.
You know,
it was definitely courage for me, but
more fearless, you know.
Yeah.
And stupid.
For me, instead of the first drink where a lot of people say, oh, yeah, I you know, I felt a part of in this, you know, magical feeling came mm-hmm. over me. I thought I was possessed by the devil and started howling at the moon, literally like some weirdo, because I watched probably too many Aussie videos. And they like try to quarantine me. We're all at some cabin and they're like, put me in a room by myself. Like that was one of the first times I got drunk. That's how it went for me.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it made me feel so much part of, because I was never really this one who was alone. Mm. I was always a part of something. But I can tell you this, it gave me this increased kind of value system of, not better than, but damn it, I'm going to different heights now.
Yeah.
I'm really insulated. I can do bigger things that are crazier and really not care about the consequences.
Yeah.
Just did not care.
Yeah. And so you're in Long Beach. You're friends with the Sublime guys at this time in the eighth grade, or when did you meet those cats?
Well,
is that a little later?
Okay. No, I met Eric the first, because I grew up in the Belmont Shore area and Naples, but in Belmont Shore, Eric I met at a very young age. I think I was like 10. Mm. And he was just about seven houses away from me, and his dad was this wonderful jazz musician and very well loved in the community. And so we had these blocks of just kids that just played and he was already into music, you know, at a very, very tender age. And so I met Eric when I was a kid, and Eric was, hell, if I was 10, Eric was only like seven.
Yeah.
You know, and wow. Bud, the drummer from Sublime, I met him in middle school when we were in like seventh grade, and we had classes together, and we loved each other immediately because we're both crazy, you know, and he's got a wonderful sense of humor.
Mm.
Yeah. Completely crazy. And then Brad was super, super close with some other friends of mine that I had grown up with since I was in preschool. And so we all just knew each other through the community.
Yeah.
Very small community, very tight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what year would that have been?
Like... Oh, my Lord. We're talking about 1978 and 77. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how, you know, that's I'm cool. old now.
That's you and me both. You and me both.
And I'm okay with it.
I'm going to let you I'm going to borrow your Just for Men later. So I need a fresh dye job.
I'm never going to color my hair. I'll probably be white by the time I leave here completely, man. But I'm cool with it.
You're a better man than me. I can't handle it. I get a picture and I'm like, who's that old guy? Oh, God, it's me. Give me some hair dye.
I'm just going to, I don't know.
I should take tips from the Z-Man.
I've got no tips, man. Just, man.
So, this is what we talk about. At first, it's working for you. It's giving you some courage. It gives you a way to connect and hang out and party and have fun and all that. When did you – and you said it didn't make you worry about the consequences. When did the consequences start?
Here's another thing I should share is that alcohol and the other stuff, it gave me that sense of that subliminal middle finger to life.
Mm, that's a good way to put it, yeah.
This kind of subliminal middle finger where I just don't so much care about really, I despised authority.
Mm.
I really, I'll share openly about this, and I came clean with it in my film, and that is, you know, I'm now a survivor today, but I mean, I was abused as a kid, you know, not by my parents, but I mean, you know, when you go through some experiences that are really heavy, the authoritative stuff really set me off.
Oh, gotcha.
So alcohol made me completely just like, man, I'm over it. I love just getting over on authority all the time.
Mm.
And all my friends did too.
Were you getting arrested a lot?
Swear on my life, I've never been arrested in my life.
Wow.
And I should have been. If life were fair, I'd be dead or in jail.
I feel like they weren't so harsh on the arrests back in the day. And it kind of kicked up, you know, later.
I swear on my life, I'm the guy who, no matter how loaded I was, when the cop showed up in the room, I'm the guy who says, yes, sir. I would say yes, sir. I'm not the guy who wants to be cool and go, yeah, F you, cop.
Oh, I thought, well, you had a problem with authority, so I thought
did,
you were
but
getting
I also,
fights or something.
No, I had a big-time problem with authority. I despised teachers and people. The moment you want to tell me something to do, the first thing in my mind is no.
Yeah, I get that.
The first thing is absolutely not.
Right.
You know, but when it came to police, I don't want to get beaten down and thrown into Long Beach jail. So I would straighten up.
Right.
I avoided so many
arrests.
You
knew how to play right.
Completely.
Yeah.
And play nice.
And play nice. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Serve me well, man.
Well, you never got arrested. That's more than I can say for myself.
And that's traveling with in nice vehicles with felonious amounts of, you know, massive amounts of cocaine, OxyContin, loaded 9mm. And I was pulled over once, and thank God they never found it.
Jiminy Christmas.
Yeah, man.
That's crazy. So, yeah, that's a story. How old were you?
That was about 3 years before I came into recovery. That was in the advanced stage of my disease.
Right.
This was certainly not when I was in my innocent teens.
Yeah, sweet and innocent.
Yeah, I wasn't driving a decent car in my teens.
No.
No.
I don't think any of us were. It wasn't cool to drive too nice a car. You kind of wanted something.
Away, man. Beat up four-door Toyota Corona with surf racks on it, and windshield wipers don't work. When it rained, I had ski goggles. I'd stick my head out the window.
That's a beautiful
Perfect,
visual.
Man. Yeah, nobody liked riding with me.
So what was the first turn when it started feeling a little dark for you?
That's an awesome question. You know, I'm going to say that darkness was setting in with me by my mid-20s. I was about 5 years into my pill addiction, maybe 28 years old, because I discovered that the prescription narcotics at a young age. In 1990, I had a back surgery. Okay. And, you know, I started mixing that in with these long nights of cocaine use and with the alcohol. And by this point, you know, those pills allowed me to really go deeper.
Yeah.
And boy, oh boy, did it change my life forever.
Did you get just super hooked, like all day, every day, popping pills?
It was. I refer to it as the drug that was like AM, PM. It never closed.
Mm-hmm.
There was no days off for that drug for me.
Yeah. Did you start doing crazy stuff to get?
Yeah, I had one legitimate doctor in San Diego that prescribed me 240 OxyContins a month. I had a doctor in Santa
Jiminy
Ana
that
prescribed
so
me
many.
160. I had a dealer on top of that. I was taking 400 plus Oxys a month, plus a couple hundred Norcos, plus fentanyl sticks.
My goodness.
I was deep.
I mean, you're a big dude, but come on.
Yeah.
That's a little excessive.
It was,
I get it.
Yeah.
No judgment.
But that's like, you know, there was no party. There was no fun.
Mm-hmm.
For many years, I had withdrawn from, you know, let's be really clear about this to the people listening or watching. There was no fun to be had with me for quite a long time.
Yeah.
The fun was gone probably by my late 20s, and I was just managing a very, very terrible sickness, which was me and a drug addiction that I could not stop.
Huh. Well, on that note, let's dip into that first song of yours. You want to set it up for us?
Oh, my gosh. We're going to talk about the Vandals' urban struggle. That's when things were fun.
Okay. Well, that's cool.
Let's talk about that for a second.
Let's do.
You're going to play it, or are we just going to talk about it?
Set up the fun days, yeah.
I mean, for God's sake, I mean, in the early days, you have a band like the Vandals, and the culture where I grew up in Long Beach, we had bands that just killed it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a legendary song, and it's well known. But anytime I hear it to this day, I still want to jump out of my car going 80. I still have that thought. I mean,
yeah.
I don't want to want the result, but it just sounds good to me.
Yeah.
And it's a damn good song to this day.
It etched neural pathways, you know, Pavlov's dog.
And you'd see that song live, or you'd hear it at a party, and, you know, people are getting thrown through drywall, and kegs are being – things are happening.
And it makes you feel at home.
Yeah, we're no longer listening to Led Zeppelin. We are now listening to this and TSOL and Secret Hate and the South Bay guys, the Descendants and Circle Jerks and all this stuff. And it's just like, let's take things up a notch.
Let's kick it up a notch.
Yeah, let's ruin the property.
So here we are on Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm here with my man Todd Zalkins, a.k.a. Z-Man. I'm your host, Wes Gear, and this is The Vandals.
I want to be a cowboy. going to be a cowboy. I'm born to be a cowboy. I want to be a cowboy. The cowboy!
That song definitely makes me want to start swirling around with no point.
I don't need any coffee now.
No. No, it's yeah, good. That's yeah. such a cool.
That was like music ding, espresso. Ding.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. It felt good. I just want to revel in that. So I'm feeling you. You know, the punk shows, the scene in Long Beach, you set it up nice. You know, we got a little bit ahead when we were talking about when the party was feeling over with the pharmaceuticals. But yeah. Let's talk about the 90s when you're, for the listeners at home, can understand your role in the Sublime family and what was going on there.
Well, you know, running around with those guys was always a mixed bag. I mean, we had a lot of joy at mm-hmm. times, and it was generally, there was a general rule of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
That was the rule of thumb, but that's what I thrived on. We talked about that earlier.
Yeah.
And I loved being around people that had very little or no limitations.
Yeah.
And that's what I loved about all three of those guys. Like when it was on, which it was on when we were together,
mm-hmm.
on like a mother, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, but one of the things that was undeniable was, chemically speaking, when they were playing well together, their music was just fabulous. And it was such a beautiful thing to bear witness to. And obviously their musical documents stand up to this day.
Incredible, yeah.
And what I was seeing transform as they were recording out at Willie Nelson's ranch, which
was... Which album was that?
The self-titled album. you know, the ones that that ultimately had, like, What I Got and Santeria and Jailhouse and April, you know, all those wonderful songs. And
I remember when DJ Product brought that over to our pad, and we were on 4th and Redondo before it was released, listening to that.
Right.
Before it was even out, yeah.
I was like, you know, Miguel, he sent a copy of it to me, and I was living in Silver Strand Beach in Oxnard at the time, and I put the tape in. Remember those tapes?
Mm.
And I froze, man. I go, it's effing over.
Yeah, you just knew
it's over, man. Yeah, it's over. It's over, and pretty soon, man, it's the elevation of this whole thing is just forget it.
Yeah.
There's no more white Econoline van now.
Yeah.
The van's about to get more comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, and the airlines are going to get a little more, seats are get a little bit more upgraded. And,
yeah.
But I mean, I just heard the musical, the quality was just so there, and it was, you know, good things around the corner. And then, they're going to do this little tour up in Northern California, you know, before they went to Europe with Jack Grisham's band, it was just a quick thing they were going to do, and I went up to Petaluma, and then they're going to they had a show in Petaluma and then a show in San Francisco the following night for like Live 105, and we were just geared up, man. We were really excited for what was
Year is this?
This is in 1996, and we had just, you know, Brad was just married to his beautiful wife Troy the week before, and they had a baby boy, Jacob, who was like 10 and a half months old, and so everything was, the rhythm of everything was going, and Brad wasn't using at the time. He was just, he was drinking, but I mean, the junk was away from him. And
meaning heroin.
Yeah, he wasn't using the heroin, and so this, you know, with the music document on the horizon, everyone was on fire for this, you know, and so the atmosphere was super electric up in Petaluma, and we were just killing it together, having a good time that night. And as we're leaving the Petaluma show, I had this big giant rental car, this town car, and I had put the band in the car with me, and I crashed to the side of the building. And Blaine Kaplan, one of their managers, says, "Dude, Z-Man, you're not driving. I'm driving from here." And so we drove back, and we dropped off the guys. And, you know, late that night, about 4 a.m., Brad tried to call me, and I just couldn't wake up because I was so intoxicated from the pills and stuff like that. And lo and behold, a few hours, we learned that he had passed. And it just, you know, it carved us all up, like, just it carved us all up, you know.
Yeah.
And the ride was over. And, it, you know, my first thought was thinking about the guys driving home without him in the van. And, of course, thinking about his wife and thinking about Jim Knoll and their whole family, that's where you first go.
Right.
Is it's over, you know, for all of those people. And the friends, yeah, all of us friends, yeah, it breaks our hearts, but the immediate family. You know,
right.
Anyway, so it just, and then I, you know, thinking about this, the idea that I couldn't answer his call, you know, people say, well, he wasn't calling me for heroin. I didn't use heroin. I didn't shoot heroin.
Right.
He didn't need money. He had money. So you just go right to, God, what was he calling for? Maybe just wanted to kind of take a cruise with a buddy or talk. And I know that he felt lonely. I know that he missed his wife and wanted to be close to home. And just little things like that.
The road's hard, man.
Yeah, man. And emotionally speaking, to tie this into recovery, when you have no tools for coping with life, which I had none at the time,
right?
You know, the grief and things of that nature, I was incapable of processing. And so I just... I allowed my addiction to just flare up like a really just gross fire.
Yeah.
You know?
Allowed it or had no choice.
I had no choice.
You know?
I had no choice, but I think I needed to further medicate because I couldn't stand the pain.
Yeah.
And I had no other way to deal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so in looking back, once I did get, you know, when I did get clean and sober, when I inventoried a lot of this stuff, I realized how much pain that caused myself and, of course, everyone else that we know. But me personally, not being able to pick up the phone was...
Well, you're just going to be in the
endless... It was devastating.
You're going to be in that endless spin of what if.
But there's a good news to it all, too. You know, I got clean and sober in 2007, and, you know, fast forward a few years, I'm doing intervention work and all this stuff, and I get this phone call from Papa Knoll saying that, you know, he couldn't lose Jacob, and that's Bradley's son.
Right.
And the most beautiful experience for me, one of the most great experiences of my life, was being able to be present to help the family.
Yeah.
It was just a wonderful thing for me.
You've been helping him set up Bradley's house?
Yeah, I co-founded. Yeah, the Knoll Family Foundation and Bradley's House is something that I co-founded with Jim Papa Knoll, and it's something that it's going to be the first treatment center of its kind, and it'll be a 6-bed facility that will treat opiate addicted musicians, and we are still raising funds for it, but we anticipate opening within about a year.
Good.
And yeah, it's in the destination's called Bradley's House. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. And then we have the. We have the anniversary of Bradley's passing coming up.
Yeah, in just a few days. Yeah, on the 25th.
25th. Gnarly. Now, I mean, you're taking me back, and I wasn't even that close, but I mean, you know, my band, Head, P.E., I don't know if we were just Head then, but we played El Ranchito on Beach and Adams with Sublime, like on a tile floor, the Almighty Sublime. I remember the
first. I was there.
I was gonna say, dude. So we're in the come on, give me some skin, homie.
I was there, man.
Okay, so we were in the same room.
Uh-huh.
Didn't even know it. And I mean, you know, everybody had like you know Sublime's early recordings and would all play them, and you could just feel like, how does not everybody have this record? These are amazing records.
Yeah.
And then you'd go see Sublime playing on a tile floor, and you know it was just you know an underwhelming experience because you want so much more for bands that you love. And then I remember playing the Seaport Ballroom.
I remember that too.
Yeah, I figured you're probably there. Was
partially
Head.
Remember.
it was
my body was there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is that? PCH and 2nd Street.
That's correct.
Right near Long Beach. Yeah.
That, and that was a gnarly show.
And we played one time with Sublime. What's this? Anyhow, down San Diego. But we remembered because we, you know, DJ Product was brothers with y'all.
Mm-hmm.
And then we grabbed them into our band. And so, you know, we knew that you guys were tight and, I don't know. We felt cool that we stole somebody from that whole Long Beach scene.
We got to mention his name. That's Doug Boyce, one of the nicest human beings on the planet.
He's so rad, but I don't think he likes it when you say his name. Yep. I did it.
Sorry, Doug.
Sorry, Doug. You guys went to school together,
love
too?
Love you, bro. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Knew him since he was a little kid, man.
We did a radio interview on tour up in Canada once, and I go, yeah, my DJ, Doug, and he pulls me aside afterwards. He goes, hey, man. I'm Product, okay? I was like, oh, yeah. Sorry, dude. Stage names.
No, he's got one of the biggest hearts on the planet.
He's so great.
I love DJ Product.
We love him.
Yep.
His art, he's so raw, was such an important infusion into what we were doing. But anyhow, don't want to make it. We just had so much respect and love for y'all, you know, and that's how the artistic community worked. We just, you know, we get inspired.
Yeah, well, collectively, you guys are getting your gig on, and it was fun, and those were some killer shows back then.
Yeah. We had a bunch of cool bands around back then. Yeah.
Yep.
So let's go into that next song there, right?
Oh, man.
You want to set it up, baby?
Yeah. You know, Wes asked me to pick a few songs that were important to me, and, you know, this next one is it's such a huge commercial hit, but I'm going to explain why I picked it, and it's from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and first off, I was a huge Peppers fan when they had Heil Slovak, you know, their first guitar player who died of a heroin overdose. But this is how sick that I was in 2007. I wasn't even paying any attention to their music, and it was on Valentine's Day, 3 days before I checked into the hospital, and I'm drinking Crown Royal. I cannot get the effect of alcohol anymore. I'm watching them on the Grammys. And I'm just blank inside, just dying inside. And they're winning Album of the Year. And they play the song. I had never even heard the song. That song, yeah. Snow.
Yep.
That Hey-Oh. And I thought this was the most beautiful effing song. And the lyrics I thought were so, and I come to find later that I believe it's recovery based. It's just a wonderful song. And every time I could freaking start crying every time I hear it to this day.
It's so pretty.
So it's a meaningful song, and that I don't ever want to forget that dark place. When I heard that song for a band that I love so much. And so, yeah, it's a huge commercial hit, but damn, it's a spot on beautiful song, man.
Yeah. Well, and you know, music I think is right up there with smell, right? For bringing back memories. So what happens is when we get that connection to something, it's just going to be like that. You'll be 95, probably don't remember anything, and you'll hear the song and you'll go right back to that moment
with really white hair. or none, but no, you're absolutely right, man.
Right back there.
That song is very healing for me. Yeah, man. Commercial, but healing, man.
It's a beautiful song. They have a great way to do of doing beautiful songs, but keeping it raw. Kind of like Sublime, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
So here we are with my man, Z-Man, Todd Zalkins on Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Gear, KX935.com. Here's the Chili's.
to decide that the things that I tried were in my life just to get high on. When I sit alone, come get a little known, but I need more than myself this time. Step from the road to the sea to the sky, and I do believe that we rely on. When I lay it on, come get to play it on, all my life to sacrifice. Hey, yo, listen what I say, yo. I got your hey. Listen what I say.
Yeah, that feels good. It puts you in a good vibe, doesn't it?
Man, it, you know, it does.
It just went right into your chest. It's an ton.
Freaking song rules, man.
So what was the thought when you, what, can you go back to that moment, that feeling? What was it?
I can tell you exactly where I was. I was on my girlfriend's couch in Newport Coast, and I had a house in San Clemente, and I was cold, alone on Valentine's Day. And just...
sounds like my every Valentine's
Day. I had a pile of pills, and I had a... and I just... how about this? I was watching people in a joyful mode, in a joyful place, and it seemed so foreign to me that I would never get there ever again.
Get it, yeah.
Ever.
This is when you're watching the
It's 3 days show? 3 days away from my going into rehab. I'm at the very last thread
of rope. Did you know it?
Huh? I knew I was going into rehab.
You did?
I was checking in 72 hours, and I'm drinking so much. Just, I know I'm going in, and I'm dying inside, but it's like when you're watching these – I was just watching people on TV, like, enjoying life, and I hadn't smiled like a true smile or any true joy in so long. I was like, I wonder if I'll ever get there, ever. And the song to me, I was just, I remember crying incessantly watching this band that I just adored. Mm-hmm. I love this band so much, and they were closing out the Grammys, winning Album of the Year, and all the streamers are coming down, and these people are dancing to the song that I had never heard. Mm-hmm. And it had been on the radio hit for... That's how withdrawn I was.
You were kind of busy.
I was a little busy. yeah, at home, alone.
With pills and stuff.
Yeah.
Huh. What made you decide to go to rehab?
I was a couple of things. First off is I did not want I love my mom tremendously. And one of the things I did not want my mom to receive is a phone call that her son had died from this disease.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of times, where I truly just didn't care because one of the things about the opiate addiction is that it, there's so much fear in crossing over the initial sickness, which is what I think, I know it prevents so many of us who are addicted to that drug. It's so scary getting through the initial stages because you're so uncomfortable. And I just did not want to break my mom's heart. There was that going on, and on top of that, internally speaking, there was my heart was starting to fail. It was skipping beats because things were starting to get weak. And I'm like, this is it. I either try this now or it's over, man. It's over. Mm. And that was it. So I crawled on February 16th, I crawled into the hospital. I chewed my last bit of morphine pills, and I still brought in a truckload of pills to the hospital, but I could do no more drugs. I was fried. And I came here to Laguna Beach, what was then South Coast Hospital. And I was
by yourself?
By myself. There was no intervention, man. I just
straight into the ER?
Straight into the ER. They were expecting me in the actually at that time they didn't take in the ER. I went right to the fourth floor, and I was treated by and I gotta mention his name, you know, Dr. Daniel Hedrick and his team treated me with love and dignity and such kindness. And those people helped save my life.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And thank you for going there.
And it was, you know, it was an awful detoxification period for me. I didn't sleep for 44 days, man. The whole month of March of 2007, I didn't sleep, bro. It was radical.
They were probably giving you a medically assisted detox.
All the medicines, and they still couldn't get me to sleep, man. Yeah. Freaking 800 milligrams of Seroquel, and I was bouncing off these walls in the hospital, just drooling. But what happened for me was that in the hospital setting, they took you down to this basement where there were these men's stag meetings, and I met the most incredible group of men that I wasn't socializing with them at first, but I was just – I could see my eyes worked. I couldn't talk very well, but I could see that these men were full of life and they were full of love and mutual respect for one another. And I could tell that they were happy. And that was a huge draw for me. And I would sit there and shake in my seat with my hospital bracelet on and my pajamas and just, I wanted so badly. And we talk about this thing as being a program of attraction and not promotion. And I wanted so badly to crawl into their skin because they were comfortable. That's what I wanted was to smile again.
They gave you hope.
big time. There, thanks for bringing that up, because there is no greater thing in recovery than to pass on that intangible thing that is known as hope. Because when you're hopeless, there isn't all the money in the world, all the material things will never give a hopeless person hope. It's the sense of, you know what, man, like, I understand you, and you can give me that hope because of your experience.
So, yeah, let's talk about that. You understood them. So they were speaking a language. Not only were they happy and all this, but, you know, to be obvious, you heard them tell your story in a sense, yeah?
Actually, no. It was their love and compassion, because it took me a while to meet a gentleman who actually had a really gnarly, gnarly detox. I needed to find that common thread.
Right.
There was a lot of guys with drugs in their story. Let's for a quick second, we have to have some common threads.
Yep.
For identification. Mm-hmm. But what I can tell you, what won me over was this overwhelming sense of love and compassion that these men had for me, and they protected me. And I mean, what do you say to a group of guys who don't know you, who just love you, and they give you a hug and they say, you know what, we're here to help save your life.
Yeah.
That's an intangible thing. Wow. This isn't like here. Here's a check. Money is not going to do this for me, man. What we need to share with people is love and understanding when we're recovering. Hey, man, you can get well if you do some things around here.
Because I did too.
Correct.
Yeah.
And you can get some joy back in your life, and you can fix some stuff. But you got to do some stuff in order to get well. And those examples of those men, and I'm glad that it's appropriate that we're here in Laguna Beach. The men here are the examples that set the stage for me to help build a foundation for my recovery. They are so important to me that they are as important as any family member of mine could ever be. And I would literally walk through fire for these guys.
Yeah, I totally get that. I appreciate you. I'm feeling you. You're going there. You know what I mean? I want to hold the space with you. This is like magic, you know, when we can be vulnerable and be men and just talk about this reality, you know?
Sometimes I know what our purpose is, you know, I appreciate that in U.S. and that you and I both are pretty sincere with our approach, and that we want to help other people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the best thing that we can do is be transparent and also share that we're vulnerable. And in order for us to, I think, to improve as men and in order to get well, is we have to sometimes be naked a bit, man.
Yeah.
And it's okay. And right or wrong, man, I've learned that in recovery, pulling down your covers, man, and this is who I really am. It's okay, man.
That's key.
You know?
It's key.
Yeah.
To use your term.
It's like it starts to minimize my fear when another man just says, hey, you know what, it's okay. It's mm-hmm. okay because you don't have to run anymore, because, see, I ran my whole life.
Yeah.
And I don't need to do that with – I don't have to do that with anybody anymore.
With that mask of pride that I got this, I'm fine, I'm okay. And it's so painful. And then we go home to that house by ourselves. We can't stop using. We want, but we can't. And it's painful and lonely. And, we got to feel our way through this, don't we? We got to let somebody in.
God, those countless occasions of looking into the mirror, looking at my silly, just gross face, just saying, why do I keep doing this? Why do I keep doing this? And today I get to look at myself a little differently and just say, you know what, you're a little bit better of a guy today, and you're a little bit better of a man.
You're an amazing human.
And how can I maybe help somebody today? And whoever thought that the key to our happiness today is to simply be there to someone else who needs a helping hand.
Yeah.
That's the medicine. For goodness sake, man.
Yeah.
It's not about my self-seeking anymore.
Right.
It's not about me.
About helping other people.
Big time, man.
Yeah, and you know what I like to share with people at home is like we come in and we have so much shame and guilt, and we did this and we feel horrible about that, and our self-esteem's low and all that. But just like you're sharing this stuff that you're not really proud of, but that's how you help other people, the same way I help other people. So if anybody is at home listening, the very things that maybe you think you don't want to tell anybody is the stuff that when you share it is going to help save their life too.
Oh, completely. And it's a foreign concept too. It's like, how is this going to possibly, it's like, hey, Wes, how is this going to help me, man? You don't understand. Yeah. You know, you don't get where I'm, what's going on with me. And like, you're able to look at me and go, dude, I do.
Totally get it. Yeah.
and we can laugh at it. And, you know, there is just limitless possibilities for ourselves to grow on the inside, which is, when I heard that term, hey, it's an inside job, I'm like, what do you mean? What do you mean an inside job? I need the outsides fixed.
Yeah.
I got to get the bank account rocking again. I got to take care of mom better again. I got to buy her the house again. The truth is that I really just want that inside of me to be okay.
Yeah. That's where it all stems from, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
100%, man.
Yeah.
100%.
So I heard what you were saying was key ingredients in the beginning was being vulnerable and connecting with the men and finding hope in them.
I left out a key word too, though, is sure. vulnerability and transparency. I think those two things are kind of go hand in hand. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so what, you know, that was, how many years was it?
Pardon me?
How many years was it sober? 11.
Yeah. Yeah.
A little more
time. A little
time
over 11 years. Yeah.
So 11, that's a long time to stay sober. What? Tell me something. What was like the first incredible thing that happened, aside from not doing drugs anymore, where you're like, wow, this sober life?
Like where it started to get good? Or
you
just
tell
like
me.
Well, I mean, the first couple of years, in my first couple of years were very trying and they were hard because my post-acute withdrawal symptoms lasted well over a year.
I heard that you had some brain issues.
I had just a lot of healing in the brain because of the long detox period. And also on Valentine's Day in my first year of recovery, my father committed suicide. And so, you know, all those years, but luckily I was able to make amends to him. And it's a big part of my story that all those years of anger towards him and my resentment and my fear of him were washed away because of what the program did for me.
Yeah.
And I got to love my dad again for a few minutes, and it was awesome. And so, you know, to come back to your question, it's like, you know, no matter what life throws at me with regards to sobriety, when I look at it as a whole, I have so much appreciation for what's been given to me and the clarity that I have kind of not just in my head, but really in my heart. Mm-hmm. I have a sense of peace that I didn't think I could ever have.
Yeah.
And I appreciate it, man. You know, and a lot of love in my heart today. I don't hate myself the way I used to.
That's a big deal.
Because I hated myself, bro, for a long time. Big time.
What helped you get over that?
A lot of work, not just in the program, but I also did some I had to get some outside help too.
Yeah.
Because I had to address some issues that the 12 steps wasn't taking care of, and it involves some childhood stuff, some abuse, and you know what? I'm not a victim today. I'm a survivor, man.
Right.
And you know, and that's why we do have people outside of this thing to give us help when needed, and I'm able to share those stories with other people who have gone through those horrific experiences, and we're able to come out the other side, not only grow from them, heal from them, but be there once again for other people to help them walk again and walk through the stuff too.
Yeah. I love that you shared that, you know, that to keep digging, you know, don't stop. You got to go. If there's still issues there, be brave enough to go after them, even if it requires a therapist or whatever.
100%, man. Because, in fact, my therapist, I hit a wall at about 6 or 7 years sober. And I can tell you, I was contemplating bailing for good.
Taking your life.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I get it.
Absolutely.
I've absolutely been there.
And the wall. Of me,
I think it's part of recovery, honestly. You know, you can't get loaded anymore. Your brain is this is my theory. Your brain's a problem solver, right? So you're in all this discomfort, emotional issues for who knows why, past stuff, current stuff. And you go, I can't drink again. Your brain's like, well, you might as well just kill yourself.
The discomfort was at a maximum, man. The RPM level was just freaking, it was just so high. And so what happened was I did some work that was painful and I got through it. But the freedom that I experienced as a result of it was absolutely just, it was so freaking joyful for me. But I had to face those fears. Mm-hmm. I confronted them with a professional. I walked through stuff and today I'm no longer this, you know, this broken little kid on the inside, man. I'm starting to grow up as a guy.
I love it. You know what that is? That is bravery. That is bravery. It's so hard for people to go and feel. Nobody wants to feel that yucky stuff, but that's where the healing is. Yeah.
And here I am talking about it on a radio show.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking about it, that I was a broken little kid and I got put back together a little bit.
Yeah, and again, this for people listening at home, this isn't like the blame game, like, oh, mm-mm, you hurt me and it's your fault.
No.
But when we have issues that are causing problems in our life currently now, then that's a sign we got to go deal with them.
No, and I'm glad that you said that. And let's clarify, man, this is no blame game whatsoever. I never blamed Big Pharma for my drug problem. I never sued Adolf Coors for my drinking problem or stole Ignia. And by the way, when it came to situations that hurt me as a kid, that's not the reason for my alcoholism.
Right.
This isn't about being in victim mode. This is about what's the solution here?
Right.
Okay. Self-pity is going to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what I need to take some type of actions to heal. Sitting on the couch complaining about it to you, brother man, is not going to get it done. I got to get well, and I got to do some stuff to do it.
Yeah, and there's a saying, pour me, pour me another drink, right?
There you go, man.
So I love it. Yeah, and so this is empowering. We stop framing ourselves. That's what I've been reading a lot about lately. We got to at some point stop when I'm a damaged child or I'm a this and that, because as long as we do that, we put a ceiling on how much we can heal.
We stay stuck.
I love that you change up. You're like, I'm not a victim, I'm a survivor, and you went after it. That's incredible. So, by the way, here we are on Rocked Recovery Radio with my man, Z-Man. I love you, dude. I love you. This has been magical for me. You're helping me. For anybody out there, what I also wanted to interject was, when you ask for help from anybody of us who's in recovery or trying to stay sober or work on our issues, mental health, whatever, you're helping us by giving us the opportunity to help you. So even though if we're in a bar, right, and you're like, hey, dude, can I get your number? It'd be like, what, bro? Right? That would be weird.
Yeah.
But in this circle, it's like, hey, man, if somebody comes up and goes, Todd, I got to talk to you. Can I get your number? It's like, in a minute. You want to do lunch? Let's hang out.
100%.
We're there for you.
Yep.
You just got to let us in. You got to give us a chance to help you.
Big time. In fact, it's an absolute, it's a joy and it's a privilege when someone says, hey, man, I need to talk to you. I need your help. It's like, hell, man, when?
Yeah.
When? Really quick, can I bring up, if a lot of the story we've talked about, it's been captured in a film. And so if you guys can check out, it's called The Long Way Back, and you can check out thelongwaybackfilm.com, or it's on Hulu, Amazon, Google Play. But, that film's been out there helping out a lot of people.
That's amazing that you did it. I'm excited to watch it. Just your story is fascinating. You're a guy, with a big heart and a lot of love and just the stuff you've been through. And, I believe that the universe has us here for a reason to carry that message. You know what I mean?
Man, it's an honor and a privilege to be hanging out with you tonight, Wes. And you know what? We got a perfectly fitting song to get out of here with. You want to know what that is?
Do we? Well, yeah.
Are we done? Are we still going?
I think we're going to rock out of here.
Let's rock out of here then.
Yeah.
Well, before we bail and rock out, dude, thank you so much.
Thank you. You're the man. I love you. And when we get done with the cameras and the microphones, I'm going to give your cute butt a hug.
All right, man.
Or how about all of you? That sounded weird, but you know what I meant.
Okay. Let's do that.
And one other thing. So is there any one last thing that you want to throw out to somebody who's struggling, or a tip or something that you think is crucial?
Gosh.
What's key?
Yeah, what is key? Well, first off, is that what is key is that there is hope, like we were talking about before, and that you do not have to do it alone. You don't have to be alone anymore. And if anyone out there is looking for help, I'm sure that Wes has got some resources out there, and you can certainly reach out to me at toddzalkins.com. But we're here to help you, man. We're here to love you and help you through it and walk you through it. But you don't have to be alone anymore.
You don't have to be alone anymore. There's somebody that always had it worse than you, sicker than you, did more drugs than you, did less drugs than you, had a better family, had a worse family. There's always somebody who had
less hair, more hair. Yeah.
You know
better
what I mean?
Skin, worse skin.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know
yes.
what I mean? I totally, yeah, yeah. So there's not a hole that's too deep that you can't get out of raise your hand and ask for help. So, this has been Rock to Recovery Radio with Z-Man Todd Zalkins. And like he was saying, we have Rock to Recovery all over the interwebs. It's ROCK torecovery.org. We have a website, Instagram, Facebook. If you ever want to reach out, we got a crew of like 12 dudes on there that love to help people.
Awesome.
Todd told you he'll help you. Check out his movie that just came out all over. I want to thank KX93.5 FM for giving us this amazing opportunity, and New Vista Behavioral Health. Great programs out there if you're needing some help. There's some not so great ones, and there's some great ones. And New Vista is definitely one of the great ones. So set up this song for me,
For the outro. You got it, man. Well, let's get out of here with a wonderful song by the band NoFX. It is called The Desperation's Gone. And I'll tell you what, you know what? Now that we're on the other side of this thing, there is no greater fitting. It's perfectly fitting. The desperation's gone.
That's right, baby.
Right? Because now that we're on the other side, the desperation is freaking gone, man.
Bye-bye.
Have a good night, everybody.
Rock to Recovery Radio.
Thank you, Wes. Right on,
brother.
KXRN LP Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach. Member supported KX 93.5.